Ladies and gentlemen, I'm sorry to interrupt. There's so much energy in the room, and there's great excitement. We're delighted that you're all here, and of course, it's because the Prime Minister is with us this morning. He arrived just yesterday, but I want you all to know he spent a couple hours this morning. I think he started in the gym at 5 o'clock, and so he's ready. This is going to be a very good session. One really tough guy. So it's going to be a good session. We're looking forward to the discussion. My name is John Hamry. I'm the president here at CSIS, and we're just very pleased to welcome the Prime Minister Odinga from Kenya. I first visited Kenya, gosh, I hate to say how long ago, but it was the week after Kenyatta died. And I remember being in Nairobi, and there was just such an awesome silence throughout the country, throughout the city, that this titanic figure, this huge figure, had passed away. And obviously the country was still in deep mourning. Since that time, of course, there's been a great deal of turmoil and tragedy in Kenya. It's a bright, sparkling, marvelous country. I don't know how many of you have been to Kenya. It's just absolutely fabulous. But it's had great challenges. And, of course, this last winter, it was really tough, very tough. And this is a country that matters. It matters deeply in Africa. It matters deeply for the United States. It is a major partner for all that we want to be good and to succeed in Africa. And to have it have this kind of turmoil is a source of worry, a source of concern. And obviously now, a great sense of hope that we have a leader of this caliber who is now leading Kenya. Prime Minister Odinga is a courageous man. Many of you who know his personal history know that he spent many years in prison. This was not uncommon in Africa when great men had to temper their outlook on the future of their country from behind bars, and to look out through those bars to see a hope and a positive future for Kenya. And he's done that. And I think he's now leading the country through a very difficult time. I was just joking to say, you know, we have a heck of a time in this country with interagency coordination. I think he's got a much more complicated problem, you know, as a byproduct of this last compromise, and something, however, we care very deeply about, and I know the depth of his character is going to carry the country through a very, very difficult time. So it's a fragile situation in Kenya, but it's a hopeful situation, and we're going to rest a lot of it on the talent that he brings to the office, and of course the very senior, talented cabinet that he has with him. So, Prime Minister, we welcome you. We're delighted you're here. One last thing. I told him, you know, Washington and America is a very sophisticated country, but we're kind of a one-trick pony, you know, and there's only one issue on the table at a time in Washington. So if a prime minister doesn't come, we're not going to focus on Kenya. So I'm glad he's here. It's important that he's here. You're going to bring a needed attention in this town to a very important country, a country we hope is a strong partner for us. So. I especially want to say thanks to Joel Barkin. Joel is going to be leading the Q&A period. But at this moment, let's turn to the star of the morning, to the Prime Minister. Prime Minister Odinga, we welcome you. Please, we invite you to the dais. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Mr. President, for those very, very kind words. He has said that he was in Nairobi at the time when President Kenyatta died, at the time when Nairobi was referred to as the city in the sun, before it became Nairobi. But now we really want to take it back to where it used to be. Let me begin by just introducing a few of my colleagues who are with me here this morning. I have with me Honorable Yusuf Haji, who is the Minister for Defense, Kenya. Honorable Ali Mwakwere, who is the Minister for Transport. Honorable Omingo Magara, Assistant Minister for Trade. Honorable George Duo, one of the co-chief whips in Parliament. Honorable Jacoyo Midiwo, also a co-chief whip, Parliament. Ambassador Oginga Ogego. And of course, we have Mike Ranibaga, who is the U.S. ambassador to Kenya. I want to say that I'm very pleased to have the opportunity to address this very distinguished audience here. I should like to begin by expressing, on behalf of the government and the people of Kenya, our most sincere appreciation for the support and the decisive role played by the United States of America in helping us to resolve the problems that we have earlier this year. Our special thanks go to the Secretary of State, Dr. Jindai Fraser, Assistant Secretary of State, Secretary of State, Dr. Condoleezza Rice, Assistant Secretary of State, Dr. Jindai Fraser, Congressman Donald Payne, who, as chairman of the House Foreign Relations Subcommittee on Africa, led other congressmen and women and senators in championing the cause of democracy in Kenya. And Senator Feingold, as well as the U.S. ambassador to Kenya, Mike Ranibaga. These distinguished Americans, together with other members of the international community, principally the United Kingdom, the European Union, the United Nations, and the African Union, and together with the mediation team that was led by the former Secretary General of the UN, Dr. Kofi Annan, together with the retired President of the Republic of Tanzania, Benjamin Mkapa, and Madam Graca Machel of South Africa, brokered a peace agreement in Kenya that led to the signing of the National Accord on February 28th this year, and the subsequent formation of the Grand Coalition Government in April this year, actually to be precise, on the 17th of April this year. Today is the 17th of June. So the Grand Coalition Government in Kenya is exactly 60 days old today. The soul searching we went through on our journey to that point, the sacrifices and compromises that had to be made, and the need to address Kenya's sense of being wronged and their unresolved grievances all made for a delicate balancing act. We had to make many difficult, perhaps unpopular decisions along the way. In this, we had the inestimable support of the civil society and the religious groups and of sections of the media. Most of all, we had the patience and the hope of our fellow countrymen and women to sustain us. In the end, Kenyans cried from the heart only for their beloved country to be saved. Following this peace agreement, a grand coalition government was formed, as I've said, and this is a government that has facilitated an equal power sharing between two political parties, that is the Orange Democratic Movement, which I represent, and the Party of National Unity, which is led by President Kibaki. The Orange Democratic Movement, or the ODM, is the largest parliamentary party, while the Party of National Unity is itself an alliance of several other smaller parties. A constitutional amendment and an act of parliament subsequently entrenched the constitution, created the post of the prime minister in the executive structure. The role of the prime minister is the coordination and supervision of the functions of government, including those of ministries. So in other words, the prime minister has got executive powers. With the formation of this new government, Kenya entered a period of a national transition under a coalition whose primary purpose is to establish a constitutional, land, legal, economic, and institutional reforms of such depth that Kenyans and the world will never again have to watch in horror as the nation finds itself nearly destroyed by the kind of chaos which we experienced earlier this year. No doubt you wondered, along with much of the rest of the world, how Kenya, long known as an oasis of peace and stability in the region plagued with a history of armed conflict, could in a matter of weeks plunge into an abyss of turbulence and mayhem normally associated with failed states. Indeed, Kenyans realized that they had actually lived the lie that Kenya was a stable nation. It used to be said that we are an island of peace in a sea of turmoil. And they would cite other countries that look at Rwanda, look at Uganda, look at Somalia, look at Ethiopia, and so on and so forth. But they did not know that what they were seeing was just a facade, and that below it, Kenya was no different from these other states. But for those of us who are accustomed to looking beneath that facade, popular dissent, fueled by long-held land grudges that have never been addressed, by revolt against perpetual poverty, against regional development disparities, and huge inequalities that characterize Kenyan society, leaving more than half of the population without adequate shelter, education, healthcare, social services, and employment opportunities, was always simmering, only requiring a trigger of sufficient magnitude to bring the people's latent anger bubbling to the surface. Spontaneous protests broke out immediately the presidential election results were announced via the nation's television screens. The people's eyes had been glued on television screens for three consecutive days. As results had been announced, then all of a sudden, live broadcast was banned, and therefore no more announcements were being made on the screens. But people then waited until the electoral commission announced what was supposed to be purported results. The response, the announcement engendered eventually grew into something more besides an expression of the people's deeply felt anger about all historical injustices. More than 1,500 people died in the ensuing violence. Many of them felled by police bullets, and over 350,000 people fled their homes. In an orgy of pent-up emotion, desperate need, hunger, and exhaustion, neighbor turned upon neighbor. People who had lived peacefully for decades and who today, in the process of rehabilitation, are relearning how to be peaceful neighbors once again. But the disputed presidential election result was, in fact, only the final act in a long drama surrounding the election. Central in this drama was the role of the body that governs the elections, the Electoral Commission of Kenya, or as it's known, ECK. One of the key proposals in a Constitution of Kenya Amendment Bill that never saw the light of the day last year, just before the elections, addressed the fundamental issues regarding the formation of the Electoral Commission of Kenya. Issues that, had they been addressed earlier, would have averted the kind of disaster that struck Kenya following the last year's elections. Key electoral areas that urgently require reform are the mode of appointment of the electoral commissioners, the independence of the electoral commission, and the source of the commission's funding. Lack of regulation in these vital areas led to a situation where the ECK, as it was composed last year, was not independent and was not, therefore, constitutionally capable of being impartial. This reform is a crucial component of the overhaul that is required across Kenya's entire legislation. And at the heart of this is a vein of need that runs through the country's constitutional framework, that is the redressing of the balance of power between the executive and all other arms of government, including the judiciary. The overwhelming need of a restructuring of institutions of government in order to ensure transparency and accountability in public life and resulting good governance. A slew of amendments over the four decades since independence has left us with a patched constitution that vests in the executive excessive power in determining the national life. Over the years, there have been several amendments to the independent constitution, which has removed power from the periphery to the center, so that the institution of the presidency has come to emasculate all other institutions of governance. That is why one of the first promises of the Grand Coalition Government of Kenya is a new constitution by April of next year. In the meantime, the travesty that recently blighted our nation must be addressed, and part of a national accord involved the establishment of several commissions of inquiry into what went wrong. One of these commissions is called the Krigler Commission. Krigler, that is led by Justice Krigler from South Africa, is investigating specifically the conduct of the Electoral Commission of Kenya, with particular regard to the disputed presidential elections. Besides receiving representations from the parties concerned, the Krigler Commission is currently taking soundings across the country from Kenyans of all walks of life. A second commission is called the Justice Waki Commission, is investigating the post-election violence. And a third commission, yet to be operationalized, will be the Commission on Truth, Justice, and Reconciliation. Another important piece of legislation, that is a bill dealing with money laundering, is about to be brought before Parliament. Terrorism and human rights violations are all matters of grave importance. The Kenyan government has instituted an investigation into allegations of torture in the Mount Elgon region, and a report is to be delivered shortly. In Nairobi, we are about to mark the 10th anniversary of the bombing of the U.S. Embassy in our capital city, a somber event that throws into sharp relief the continuing need for international cooperation in this field. And as you know, there are very many Kenyans lost their lives in that incident. On the side of the economy, we have just this month launched the Vision 2030 blueprint, a blueprint of our nation's development that is anchored on three pillars, and which has taken us exactly a month since the swearing in of that other government, the government, to come up with a blueprint, because we had a coalition of three major parties which had their own manifestos. There was need to set up a task force to harmonize these three manifestos into one. But last week, on Tuesday, we launched that blueprint and a vision 2030. On Thursday, the first budget was read by the Minister for Finance. This blueprint rests on three pillars. That's economic, social, and political reform. And it's designed to facilitate Kenya's journey to the second world status within the next 22 years. Medium-term strategic plans for the coming 5 years are being coordinated by my office. We aim to have an informal consultative group with international partners in the next 2 months and are planning a series of investor conferences, the first to take place in Nairobi in September and others later in both the U.S. and also in Europe. The office of the Prime Minister is crucial in laying the groundwork for a better Kenya. The office itself is a new institution and therefore requires capacity creation to ensure its effective functioning. We are grateful to have received a pledge from His Excellency, the U.S. Ambassador to Kenya, of $500,000 in order to develop the capacity of the office to be able to coordinate and supervise functions of the government, including dealing with issues such as corruption, inefficiency, justice, etc. But to do this, of course, the cost will be much higher. We already find ourselves with a bloated cabinet that must be funded, and people have actually criticized this cabinet. Many have criticized, but it was an avoidable result of the particular multi-party alliance that makes up of President Kibaki's Party of National Unity. Because of its size, it was decided that the cabinet would function more efficiently if business were conducted primarily in committees. Five of these committees have been formed, namely, one on infrastructure, finance and administration, social services, and productive sector, and security. And of those five committees, the President chairs one on security, and I chair the other four, the remaining four committees. The electoral and social crisis we experience has badly damaged our economy, and our growth rate might sadly not reach earlier expectations. It is projected that as a result of the post-election crisis, the GDP growth will drop this year to 4.5% from 7% of last year. The situation is made worse by the rapidly rising cost of oil and the world food crisis. The crisis and resulting insecurity and the displacement of hundreds of thousands of Kenyans meant many crops were not planted in time, nor have the rains been kind to us this year. As a result, we face a very difficult 12 months ahead. While trying to ensure the safety and food security of our people, we also have to deliver the promised institutional and constitutional reforms. The coalition government in itself is a new concept. It is for the first time that on the African continent we have a grand coalition government. So this is a pioneering experiment. It will demand many decisions along the way that arise simply from the newness of its own structure. It will require a supreme effort of coordination to ensure transparency and accountability where none existed before. In the midst of this, we must address urgent economic problems, taking steps to limit inflation, to attract foreign investment, and to get our foreign exchange earners, such as tourism, back on track. It is a daunting agenda, but I'm optimistic of our success. The people of Kenya have demonstrated their determination to pursue what is right for this country through democratic means and through holding their leaders to account. The people of America have done it over and over again. We hope to take inspiration from the experiences of our international partners. In doing so, President Kibaki and I are aware that we cannot do everything overnight. It is in the nature of people to look for flaws and rifts and disagreements, and the extreme politicization of our media and of our people in Kenya means that the contentious issues are bound to arise in a coalition such as ours, embracing as it does so very many different shades of opinion that must be harmonized by patience and compromise, sometimes assume unwarranted magnitude. It is vital for us and our development partners to understand that President Kibaki and I are equally and similarly determined that together as a partnership, we shall lead our nation forward to the place where we all want to be. My appeal to you today is that you remain strong partners of my country in our hour of its greatest need. Americans on both sides of your political divide have proved invaluable friends to Kenya, and we hope whoever you elect as president later this year will maintain a strong focus on Africa and on Kenya in particular. Kenya and the U.S. have enjoyed a powerful relationship dating back to many years. As the Prime Minister of Kenya, I am determined to ensure that this relationship continues and is strengthened through shared democratic and social values and through the development of vibrant partnerships, all facilitated by the hand of friendship and cooperation extended in both sides. We remember with fond nostalgia the days when hundreds of thousands of Kenyans came to the United States for studies and a program that was called the Airlift, which was spearheaded by the late President John F. Kennedy and the late Thomas Joseph Mboya of Kenya. So the USA has enjoyed historical relationship with Kenya, assisting Kenya to attain its independence from colonialism. And since then, we have enjoyed cordial relationship in economic, in social, cultural, and even security fields. We'd like to see these relations strengthened and expanded under this new Grand Coalition government. As I've said, this is an experiment. It's a first on the African continent. No country in Africa has had a coalition government. Africa is moving from a phase of single party, no party, military rules, to democratic government. We see that in the success in other fields, the reversions in other places. But generally, we are moving forward. As somebody said, two steps forward, one step backward. We are advancing. So I believe that what you have achieved in Kenya can be used as a model to be followed in other African countries that are in transition. What we are seeing in Zimbabwe is not very pleasing. And I've spoken about this openly before, and I've been censored. But I have no regret in repeating it again here, that Zimbabwe is an eyesore, an embarrassment to the African continent, an example of how not to do it in Africa. And that it is sad that many African heads of state are quiet when the disaster is looming in Zimbabwe. There is no point in letting Mugabe proceed with the repeat of an election when nobody knows how many votes were cast in the last elections. How many registered voters do we have in Zimbabwe? How many votes did Mugabe get? How many votes did Tsvangirai get? We are only being told 48% against 43%. Of what? You cannot organize yourself to face an election when you don't know how you fared in the last one. How many votes did I get in this region? Where am I weak so that I can strengthen myself? So it is a complete sham and a farce to Africa. We are determined to show that in Africa, a country can rise from crisis like Kenya and move towards prosperity. Thank you very much for listening to me.
Well, we have just heard a vintage Raila, if I may say so, by calling him as he's called in Kenya. I find myself a little awkward to refer him as Mr. Prime Minister now, having known him for a number of years. Your address, we have, fortunately, quite a bit of time for questioning. I would only insist that you ask a question, not make a speech, and I will try to be ruthless in that regard. I'd like to begin by taking the prerogative of the chair of asking the first question to pick up on a point that the Prime Minister covered with some of us at breakfast. And we asked him about the dynamics of his working relationship with President Kibaki and particularly his assessment of the way forward on this very crucial issue of the new constitution that he mentioned several times in his presentation, because there are a number of thorny issues there, devolution, which he's also been very clear in his own remarks on the campaign trail, executive power, et cetera. So perhaps, Mr. Prime Minister, you could begin with that, and then we'll field from the audience we have about 40 minutes, so this ought to be a good and lively discussion.
Thanks so much, Joel. The issue of a constitution has been with us for a long time in Kenya. In fact, it's over 15 years ago since Kenyans started working on the constitution. And some of you may remember that it ended up with a referendum that rejected the draft constitution. That was because there were some contentious issues over which there were no agreement. But I have attended a meeting of experts on constitutions, some of the most qualified international constitutional lawyers. And within that circle, it is believed that the Kenya's constitution making has been the most consultative that has ever been. Because nowhere else in the world have they set up the kind of elaborate structure that we set up in Kenya, going up to the villages to collect the views of the people. When these views were collected and a draft constitution was prepared by the Constitutional Review Commission. Then they were published. Views were invited. People commented. Then the draft was again improved. Then a structure was created at the village to again now collect people's views. Then the constituency. Then at the district, people again commented on that draft. Thereafter, another draft was prepared, again published. Again, views were invited, and after which, then a final draft prepared, which was then submitted to the Constitutional Conference, what's called the Bomas Conference, which went on for months. In the end, a draft was prepared. So this is what then the final draft, which was agreed on, was not acceptable to a few in the executive. The one that was altered by what was called the Cliffy draft, which eventually was rejected in the referendum. Now, what are the contentious issues? The executive, the structure of the executive, which was meant to devolve power to another institution of the office of the Prime Minister. Then the other one is the devolution, the structure of devolution. And the other one was land, and the other one was the issue of religion. Now, the executive, of course, there are those who wanted the centralized system of government. There's been the question of presidential versus parliamentary system of government. There are those who believe that in a society so divided by ethnic rivalries, presidential elections enhance ethnicity. Because when people go for elections, each community see a candidate from their community as their flag bearer in the presidential elections. We saw it in 2002. We've seen it again in this 2007. So that this need to move towards a parliamentary system where the competition among political parties rather than among individuals is one. Then, of course, there are these people who argued that two centers of power cannot coexist, and therefore you need to centralize power in the institution of the presidency. Because those miss the point, because it is the authoritarian, imperial presidential system that has let Africa down, that we're moving away from. So there's need to devolve power. Fortunately, this crisis helped us resolve that issue. Because now we already have created two centers of power. We have an executive president and an executive prime minister. These are amendments which were brought about by the crisis. And they say that usually best constitutions are written at the times of crisis. Now, on the issue of land reform, several documents have been prepared. And it is a matter of putting them together to then come up with a final document that will be acceptable. With regard to religion, there really was not a problem. It's just a few religious leaders who were thinking that maybe the Muslims were had more attention in the constitution because we had the provision of a Qadi's court, which was the only contentious issue which was being opposed by some Christian leaders. But the Qadi's court has been in the constitution since independence, and it does not hurt a fly. So that's not really a big issue. What we have agreed there for Joel is that we are going to go through the route of experts as opposed to the constituent assembly. A team of experts is going to be appointed. We have made provision for even three experts from outside the country together with the local experts to look at these contentious issues and to try to develop a consensus. Once a consensus is developed, then we will take this to Parliament. And if we get the numbers in Parliament and it's approved, then it will be taken to a referendum. That's why we believe that we can be able to deliver a new constitution within 1 year. Thank you.
Okay, let's start over here. Would you please identify yourself?
Abdulrahim Fuqara from Jazeera. Prime Minister, as you said in your opening remarks, the continent of Africa continues to be riddled with hot spots and conflicts. Two of those hot spots I'd like to ask you about, Somalia and Sudan. What is your assessment of the way the Bush administration has handled those two conflicts, and what have been the implications of that policy for your country, Kenya? And do you think a Barack Obama administration would make any difference whatsoever to United States foreign policy towards Africa? I bet you expected that question anyway. Thank you, sir.
Somalia and Sudan, of course, are some of the hotspots on the African continent. And as you know, Somalia is just next door to Kenya, both of them. We share a common border. And the instability in Somalia, of course, contributes very greatly to instability in Kenya. And therefore, we would like to see stability return back to Somalia. I really don't want to blame the Bush administration in both Somalia and in Sudan, because I believe strongly that these are African problems, and Africans themselves must take responsibility first than begin to blame foreign countries. As a Pan-Africanist, I feel ashamed and pained when we begin to pass the buck and blame other foreign powers. How has Britain handled this, France handled this, America handled this? Why? What is it that the AU could not do that they required Bush administration to come and do in Somalia? I think this is basically a failure. And if you fail yourself, then you should not blame yourself when foreigners come and do things which you're supposed to do, even if they bungle them. So I think that the AU need to take a leading role, and then this role should be complemented by other friends of Africa, in my view. As whether Obama administration will be different from Bush, I don't want to speculate. As you know, there was a professor of Kenya called Professor Ali Mazrui who posed a question: which country, the U.S. or Kenya, will have a first Luo president? This day, I answer that question by saying that Kenya has already beaten the U.S. Kenya has a Luo president who has not been sworn in. Thank you.
Okay, in front.
Mr. Prime Minister, Honorable Prime Minister, ministers, ambassadors, and ladies and gentlemen, good morning. I'm so happy for CIS to organize. My name is Rosemary Segero. I'm the president of Amani Club Ambassadors, which advocates on crime, violence, and Segero's international group. Mr. Prime Minister, I'm so happy. I'm speaking as a Kenyan woman and mother. The violence in Kenya was so bad. My nephew was killed. Michael Segero was among those who were killed. I'm asking a question: what will happen to those who were killed? Are they going to be compensated by the government, or what is going to happen? And the other thing, Mr. Prime Minister, me as a concerned Kenyan, I also want to thank our Ambassador Okeko. He really worked so hard, talked so hard in this country day and night, advocating and talking about peace in Kenya. So Kenyans here in the leadership of Ambassador Okeko really were very concerned. So I want you, as the Prime Minister, from today, I have written you more in my letter, go and involve me as a Kenyan woman and other Kenyans who live in the USA to be part of the Kenyan constitution and building Kenya development. Thank you so much, and more you'll read in my letter. God bless you, and God bless Kenya.
Okay, Prime Minister Odinga has asked that we take two or three questions together. Hopefully they'll be on related subjects like the one just asked, the IDPs, etc., over here.
Thank you, and thank you, Prime Minister. I have a two-part question. The first part is about PEPFAR and U.S. Global AIDS initiatives. The second part is about Vision 2013. Oh, I'm sorry. My name is Paul Davis. I work for HealthGap here in the United States. So Kenya, the first part is that Kenya, with its own resources and commitment and some support from the United States AIDS program, has made a lot of progress towards starting to get control over HIV and AIDS. The U.S. Global AIDS Initiative needs to be renewed this year and has been passed by the U.S. House of Representatives by a large bipartisan majority. Likewise, there's a near certain supermajority in the U.S. Senate. However, a tiny handful of senators, led by one Senator Tom Coburn from Oklahoma, are holding up passage of the bill. What would the impact be if the U.S. support for the fight against AIDS, TB, and malaria was withdrawn? What is your message to U.S. senators about renewal of the PEPFAR program? The second part of my question was, late last year, in developing a set of recommendations for U.S. Congress about renewing the AIDS program, we were able to, we partnered with a really amazing organization called Groots Kenya. They have tens of thousands of members all across the country and in every district, working with local chiefs on community development issues.
Would you please get to the question?
Yeah, thank you. I was fortunate enough to meet with our members in Kendu Bay, Kakamega, Korogocho, Kisumu, et cetera.
Just
as part of the Vision 2013 initiative on community development, will your office engage in a dialogue at the community level with organizations like Roots Kenya, these grassroots women who are working with chiefs at the local level on community development? Thank you.
Well, Rosemary, yeah, I thank you so much for your sense of patriotism as a Kenyan. Yes, many Kenyans lost their lives as a siege. Over 1,500 people lost their lives. Some of these were as a result of inter-ethnic fights and attacks. Some of them as a result of the security officers using excessive force, particularly using live bullets. So this is an issue that is under debate right now in our country. I cannot tell you that there will be any kind of compensation as yet, as you will have heard about the question of amnesty that is being discussed. The matter has even been discussed in the cabinet. It has been agreed that those who committed, who just participated in demonstrations, there were quite a number of people who were just protesting and eventually were arrested by the police. And because they have been confined for a long time, longer than the period required by law, the police then came up with some trumped-up charges like robbery with violence to keep them in custody, that they should be released. But that the people who committed crime against humanity, like murder, arson, and rape, should be subjected to fair trial. So this is how this matter is being dealt with. But then we've also said that the security officers who also used excessive force to shoot to kill should also be brought to justice. Mr. Davis, yes, I want to say that we are very grateful to the U.S. government for the assistance that it has given the Kenya government, particularly in the fight against HIV/AIDS. It has produced very tangible results, as you have seen that the new infections have actually declined very substantially as a result of this very successful campaign. We would like to see this program continued and also expanded. And therefore, whoever is campaigning for scaling it down or for canceling it is actually doing a great disservice to the people of Kenya. Thank you.
My name is Robert Griffin. Prime Minister, thank you very much for your remarks. I'm delighted to know that politicians in Kenya are making peace with each other and looking ahead. But I want to ask you about the social fabric of the country. You mentioned justice and some land reform issues, but how do you go about reestablishing a social fabric in a country that was so ripped by violence and now where people are separated in order to find systems where people can live together in harmony?
Well, yes, you know that Kenya is not the only country that has gone through this kind of experience, fortunately. Therefore, we have several examples to learn from. You know, South Africa went through some of the most trying moments, serious social turmoil, just the period before the end of apartheid. It took them quite some time, but they went around it in a very systematic way. You remember Archbishop Desmond Tutu's commission, the Truth, Justice, and Reconciliation. And that's the reason why we actually are trying to follow that route, that what we've been through is not just an accident, as I've said. It is as a result of acts of omission and commission over a long period of time since independence. That's why we are talking about historical injustices that have been committed against certain people. So we need to produce a process that will enable people to own up and forgive each other so that the society can move on. Otherwise, you'll have this pent-up anger, which you just carry on, and you'll not be able to resolve this social conflict within the society. we have several groups and teams that are working with these communities, you know, conducting counseling and trying to reconcile these societies so that people appreciate each other, agree to work together, to live together. You see, for the first time, Kenyans have now begun to even understand and respect each other. They have, because having gone through this crisis, they know the value of each other. The landlords know that without tenants, there's no business. The bar owners also know that if without the customers, there's no business. Those transporters, what we call the matatu operators, equally know that it is the passengers who make them have business. So the interconnectivity within the society has become so much in focus. And therefore, people are discussing. And I think the debate that's going on in our country is very, very useful for laying a firm foundation for a united country.
David Throop, and I should warn you, he's an old fundi who traverses particularly Central Province.
Thank you very much, David Throop of CSIS and George Washington University. Congratulations, Mr. Prime Minister, on your appointment. And I have a request and then a question. 6 weeks ago, I was asked by the Kriegler Commission to submit a report to them about the general election, which I did 2 weeks ago. And I authorized the commission to release it to interested parties last week. So far, the Office of the President and the PNU have contacted me and said that they are happy to facilitate meetings in Kenya when I arrive, which will be in the latter part of July. And I would like to request you, on behalf of the ODM, to facilitate equal arrangements. It's not fair simply to talk to one side of the problem rather than both sides. Clearly someone who's worked primarily in Kikuyu land has a better knowledge of the Kikuyu and context there than in the ODM. But I would be most appreciative if you could arrange for me to meet people in the ODM and particularly in the contested constituency results. My question is about the problem of the Kikuyu in the Rift Valley. There is a kind of political mythology which has developed over the course of the last 15 years since the first call for Majimboism. The problem is, what do you do? How are you going to reconcile the fact that many of these Kikuyu have actually lived in the Rift Valley now for virtually a century, that by 1920, one in four Kikuyu lived outside of Central Province in the Rift Valley, and particularly the issue of forest squatters, the violence in Merlo, the Maoist escarpment, the burnt forest, that historically in the 1920s, 30s, 40s, the vast majority of people who were forest squatters were Kikuyu. How are you going to address the problem that the Kalenjin see this as their land and part of their historic community, whereas in fact the Kikuyu residents have actually been there for 80 or 90 or 100 years and they simply cannot be uprooted from those areas?
On the first one, yes, I'll be more than happy to facilitate a meeting with the ODM leadership. By the way, David is also a friend. He's written very extensively in Kenya and is usually very fast with his reports and books. Sometimes we don't share the common view, but but all the same, I really respect him as an intellectual. So our people will be too happy to give you the side of the story so that something much more objective comes out. You told Justice Kriegler that it is terribly important for Kenyans to get to know the truth if only for the purposes of avoiding recurrence of what we went through in these last elections. As regards the Kikuyu in the Rift Valley, yes, it is true that a number of those people were settled there in the 20s, some in the 30s, and that they've been there for generations. As a matter of fact, there are quite a number of those IDPs in Central Province who don't know where their parents came from. They go there and they don't know where to go to. Some of them don't know whether their parents came from Kiambu, from Muranga, or from Nyeri, for that matter. Now, then, of course, those were the settlements in the colonial period. But then came the settlements after independence. In my view, I think that the way in which these settlements were done is itself the cause of the problem that we're having. I don't think that it was a best way to carry out settlements, that you took fairly productive agricultural land and parceled it out into small units, 3 acres, 5 acres, and when this generation then gets children, he had 5 acres, he again now subdivided into 1 acre, then eventually to half an acre, and so on and so forth. So we have created just a rural slum in that area. And what should have happened was that you should have isolated particular areas for residential purposes, and then left the farm itself as a large estate. What happened in Europe during the Industrial Revolution period. So that somebody knows that in the bigger farm he owns 5 acres, 10 acres, or whatever, and that but the farm is farmed collectively, so that it is known that if we have this yield per acre, then this fellow would know that out of my 5 acres I'll get so many bags. That way you can be able to provide proper services. Here you can provide water, you can do sanitation, you can bring electricity and so on. But more importantly, you'll have a Kikuyu living next to a Kalenjin, to a Maasai, to a Luo, to a Kisii, and so on. So it will not be easier to identify this settlement the way they are. As things are now, it is very easy to identify there's a Kikuyu home, go and burn it. There's a Kalenjin home, don't burn it. Because when you're flying over that that area, it's very interesting. You find a home completely destroyed next to another home which is standing intact. So I think that would be a better way of dealing with this issue of land in the area, because the Kalenjins also felt that they were deprived of their pieces of land when the settlement was taking place in the Rift Valley during that time when they called it the White Highlands. So I think that these are issues that need to be now dealt with when we're dealing with the comprehensive land reform. How do we make this land available to these people as a people? And how do we deal with the Kalenjins themselves in that area? So I think this is what we must discuss and actually dispose of as a country. Now, but I want you to know that this is not just confined to Kikuyus alone. During these conflicts, you have very many Luos who are chased away from Central Province. Limuru, in Tigoni, in Ruiru, in Dhika, quite a number of them were actually killed. Also, even in Naivasha, you remember they burnt a home where the 19 people were burnt alive in a house. They were all Luos. Now, you have these IDPs who are again sent back to Nyanza. Their great-grandparents are the ones who went to Central Province. Like in my place in Bondo village, there are about 5 IDPs. They were sent away from Central Province. As they were going back, they were saying, our home is Bondo in Siaya. But when they reached Bondo, because once upon a time, Bondo was part of the Siaya district. Since then, Bondo is now a district, says a district. When they arrived in Bondo, they were said, where is your home? They say, Bondo in Siaya. But see, this is Bondo. Now they didn't know where to go to. Now they're hanging there in Bondo. People are laughing at them. They're being told that, look, if Barack Obama could come from Chicago and knew where Nyangoma Kogelo is, where is how about you were just in Limuru? you can't be serious. But the fact that the guy never intended to go back to Bondo in Siaya district, that's how it is. So this problem is just not confined to one community. It's general, it's a national problem. Thank you.
Here in the back. Paul Ndiho, VOA News. Earlier, Mr. Honorable Prime Minister, you talked about being censored whenever you talk about Zimbabwe. I was wondering if you could speak more to that, and what role can you play, you as a leader and all the other African leaders, come June 29th when President Mugabe loses the election and takes cue from the other African leaders who have done it in the past? Thank you.
Nicely concise question. Paul Wolfowitz.
Mm-hmm. Paul Wolfowitz, American Enterprise Institute, formerly World Bank. Mr. Prime Minister, you talked about the need to reverse the tendency of bringing all power and influence from the periphery to the center. My impression is there's something called the Constituency Development Fund, which was enacted a few years ago for the purpose of doing that, and I wondered what your view is of that measure and whether it's working or whether it could be made to work better.
Yes, thanks so much, Paul. Sure, it's called the CDF, the Constituency Development Fund, which was introduced in the last parliament. And as things stand right now, it's about 2.5% of the total development budget. And it has been very successful in devolving resources to the grassroots. What we are saying is that it is the first phase or stage of devolution. And it has proved to be very, very successful. And that's also the reason why people now believe that devolution will be an answer to deal with the issues of regional disparities and inequalities in development in the country. So we are going to be discussing in this devolution, the units of devolution. And it's been agreed that constituency should be the starting point, and maybe you come up with another unit bigger than the constituency, which combines several constituencies, that will become a region as another unit. And you create a proper capacity to utilize those funds more transparently, as it were. But I agree with you that definitely the CDF has been a very good success in the country. As regards Zimbabwe, I've said that my concern stems from my commitment to Pan-Africanism, that I'm a Pan-Africanist, that is, and I'm an Afro-optimist, as opposed to Afro-pessimists, that is, those who believe in the ability of the African people to develop Africa. You may wish to know that 5 days ago, following my comment in Cape Town, I was declared an enemy number one of Zimbabwe by Mr. Mugabe. Thank God I have no intention of going to Zimbabwe when Mugabe is still there. I'm saying that gone should be the days when African leaders used to misrule their people, and the rest of Africa was quiet under the guise of what was called non-interference in the internal affairs of a sovereign state. I'm thinking that AU should have been different from OAU, because in OAU, most of leaders were gagged, they could not speak, because there was in the OAU charter a provision that you should not interfere in the internal affairs of a sovereign country. But now AU should be different. See, EU moved into Bosnia to deal with Milosevic. Now, here is a case where we are actually repeating the same thing that used to happen under OAU. In the OAU days, remember, Idi Amin Dada could kill Ugandans the way he was killing and was still being elected as the chairman of the African Union, Organization of African Unity. That was created people like Jean Bedel Bakasa, the emperor of Central African Republic, Mobutu Sese Seko, Kungwaza Banga, the Ngwazi Kamuzu Banda of Malawi. There was a one who was called Matias Nguema of Equatorial Guinea, who really actually threatened the population with extinction. So I'm saying that we should be different now, and the African leadership should be able to stand up and say that what is happening in Zimbabwe is not acceptable. It's not acceptable by any other standards. Because Mugabe has publicly said that he can only hand over power to a member of his own party. So then why are we having a rerun of elections when the incumbent has already told the whole world that he will not hand over power? He has even threatened to use the army, the so-called the war of veterans that are still there. Now, what percentage of the people of Zimbabwe were there when they were fighting against Ian Smith? More than 50% of the people don't know it. The fact that he participated in liberating the country does not give you a title for the country that you own it. If it's a question of fighting for liberation of a country, nobody has done it more than Madiba in South Africa. He was in prison for 28 years. He came out, elected president. He served only one term, 5 years, and said, let somebody else continue. Mugabe has been there since independence, about 28 years. What he did not do in those 28 years, he will not do in the next 5 years. Inflation is over 200,000%. They have introduced a $500 million bill. A loaf of bread costs $100 million. What kind of economy is that? So, and does the world want to allow Mugabe to continue for another 5 years? There are 4 million Zimbabweans living in South Africa. That is the cause of this xenophobic attacks against other people. So even South African government needs to come out strongly. President Mbeki needs to come out strongly and speak against Mugabe and against impunity in Zimbabwe. Thank you.
Okay. Regrettably, we have only about 6 minutes left. That means basically two questions that are short because the Prime Minister has been very generous and has given his detailed answers. The lady in the back with the white blouse.
Mr. Prime Minister, Molly Davis with the Department of State. You mentioned both police abuses and human rights abuses in your opening remarks, and I was wondering how you were going to address police reform and also prosecution of the human rights abuses other than implementation of the Wakey Commission. Thank you.
And over here.
Christine Guthiumi with the Academy for Educational Development. My question is to what you had said earlier regarding the number of Kenyans who have come abroad to go for higher education. In regards to the theme of this discussion, how best do you think we should tap into the wellspring of really well-educated Africans, or Kenyans especially, who are out here in the diaspora, and how best that they can help you towards this Vision 2030?
Good question.
Yes, the lady there from State Department. I think the issue of human rights abuses I've mentioned before, and I think that the best way to deal with it is through this TRC, the Truth, Justice and Reconciliation Commission, will enable us to deal with it much more comprehensively than in an adversarial manner. That will be my response to that issue. As regards the the diaspora. I have said in the past that our diaspora is a very important component of our society. The Kenyan diaspora, for example, contributes immensely to the Kenyan economy. The remittances back home to Kenya amounts to over $1 billion U.S. dollars by the figures of last year. So this is a resource that we can better harness. We also know that we have some of the most highly qualified Kenyans living outside here. There's some of them who are here through no choice of their own, because the conditions back home was not attractive. We are trying to create attractive conditions that will enable us to get some of them to come back to Kenya. So it is a two-pronged approach. There's one about the contribution to the Kenyan economy. We are actually encouraging them to invest more in Kenya. And we are making it easier now for people to remit money back home. And we are working with several financial institutions to do that. We would like them to now make use of the internet to make even more contributions to our country, because as you know, the world has now become a global village, as it were. We are going through the constitutional reform to deal with the issue of dual citizenship, which I know that quite a number of Kenyans outside quite desire. But we are going to, we're in the process of setting up a diaspora desk in the office of the Prime Minister to be able to coordinate these issues. Thank you.
Well, I very much regret that we have to bring this to a close. On behalf of the audience, the many people who came, and particularly CSIS, thank you very much, Raila Odinga, for coming back. This is the second time. We hope we'll see you again on your next visit, and thank you all.